Fix it. CKUT, the number one radio station in Montreal. We give you the sun, the moon, the rain, the stars and the mountain. CKUT give you the word.
It can happen to you if you're young at heart. For it's hard you will find to be narrow of mind.
Good evening and welcome to Older Women Live for March 2022. Feminist radio from an elderly perspective. That is, the women sitting around this Zoom table this evening are old and have seen a thing or two. Tonight we're going to be looking at the situation in the Ukraine as we understand it. Our guests are Judy Berlin and Martine Eloy from the collective Échec à la guerre, and Marlène Rateau, Brisna Kajero, and myself, Rosemary Wally, all members of the Older Women Live Collective. And a big thank you to Brisna for hosting the webinar. First, we must start off by saying we stand for peace. We are most concerned over the hysteria and the jingoism of the cry for war. Sadly, this is where the media and the public come together. People love stories of individual heroism. Even though, as in the case of Ukraine, where the president asked citizens to defend their houses, even though the citizens have no military experience and the enemy is a nuclear power, is surely suicidal. We also decry the racism. We are happy that refugees are being helped, but we can't help noticing that the people of the Ukraine, white, blondish, look like the majority of Canadians, as opposed to the people of, say, Afghanistan, whom NATO and the US bombed to dust every day for 20 years, and nobody went to their aid. We all know that now those same people are dying of cold and starvation because the US is withholding their funds. But there's not a word of dissent over the terrible bombing and destruction of this very beautiful country. The same is true about Libya, Yemen, Syria. We call for an immediate ceasefire, but sadly our voices will not be heeded. The arms trade is ruling supreme. And disinformation, of course, is a fundamental component of war.
So we thought we would start by looking at the whole issue of the mainstream media.
If you, well, actually, I think it's a really important point. We always say that truth is a first victim of war, and we really see it in this case. Many things strike me since the beginning of this war. Well, one which is not really new, but is the Machiavellic that is given to us. There's the evil on one side and the good on the other. And it almost seems as if they're staging something out there. Of course, then everything that is presented of the other side is presented in an extremely almost caricatural manner. And this is not to say that the invasion of Russia, the invasion by Russia of Ukraine is definitely an outright violation of human rights and can be condemned and without any doubt. However, it really struck me when I hear of the fact that, oh, we should be pursuing Putin for crimes against humanity by the very people that have been committing crimes against humanity for the past decades, without any mention of the fact that these are crimes and without any recognition of the human disaster and pain and deaths that were the result of our country's intervention in Iraq, in Syria, in Libya, in Afghanistan. That's the first thing that has really hit me. And I think we have to be aware that there is a propaganda machine out there. And obviously, it seems to me the objective of this is to build support in our countries for our country's governments. So it's important for them to show all the bad things that are being done by others in order to justify that we continue supporting them. Then, of course, the other thing that has struck me is the outright racism of some of the reporting. When you read something like a reporter that says, yes, but you know, it strikes our imagination because we never thought that, you know, these blonde, blue-eyed people, it would happen, or even that it could happen to them. Well, of course, I have to choose my words, he says. And then you feel like saying, well, if he's chosen his words, what would he have said if he hadn't chosen them? You know, so that's just one example, but there have been many in the past weeks. Outright racism. All of this is, on the one hand, like almost naively admitting that it's all right to commit these war crimes when you're dealing with non-white populations, you know, and they even use the word when they refer to civilized European civilizations, people that are being affected, as opposed to people in Afghanistan and Iraq and so on. So it shows some of the really not the worst aspects, I would say, of our civilizations. But I would cut it off here. Let some other people add on, jump in.
Probably I would like to add that the problem with the mainstream is that it is aligned with the military and political agenda of the United States and the Western countries and NATO. So that's the first great difficulty that we have. In order for us to really be informed, we have to go to alternative media, or we really have to look for writers that present a more balanced opinion or a view of what is happening. I mean, they blame Russia for invading Ukraine, but they do not mention that NATO was created in 1949 to detain Russia during the Cold War with the excuse of fighting communism. But that's not the case anymore. And still, they continue. They shifted and tried to encourage membership by trying to get countries aligned to their plan. So I think that's really the big issue.
And what Martin was saying reminds me of something I heard that Dr. Paul Farmer, who recently died, and I didn't know much about him, in fact, until he died, unfortunately, because he was obviously a great person, but it was said of him that he attributed all the evil in the world, everything that's bad in the world, is rooted in the thinking that some lives matter less than others. Mm-hmm. And I thought, isn't that a simple one phrase summing up of everything? Mm-hmm. Some lives matter less than others are capable of doing all this. And of course, as Martin said, we have this portrait of the good Ukrainians versus the bad Russians. But and that means, of course, that those of us who are calling for the dissolution of NATO and all that, then we get painted as apologists for Putin. And it isn't that way at all. We don't think what Putin did was justifiable in any way. You can't go around, invading people and dropping missiles on them. But that doesn't mean that we think the blame is all there either.
Dear Bosco, Poutine ne manque pas une occasion de leur rappeler les invasions qu'ils ont faites, que ce soit en Irak, en Libye ou ailleurs. Ils sont au Yémen aussi, un peu, quelque part, dans tous ces endroits-là. Donc, il leur rappelle et il faut leur dire que maintenant, vous m'accusez, sûr que Poutine n'a pas les mains blanches non plus. Parce que Poutine, ce qu'il a fait en Tchétchénie et ailleurs, là, c'est terrible. Mais ils se ressemblent. Ils se ressemblent. Et dans cette guerre en Ukraine-là, on ne peut pas d'emblée dire qu'il y a un méchant et un bon. Je pense que ce sont des méchants qui s'affrontent, définitivement.
So I'll try and summarize this for you. Marlene pointed out that in the various invasions that we've seen in the past decades, whether it be in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, it's not very different. And this is not to say that that Putin is not a terrible character who does a lot of harm, but we have to draw their attention to the fact that there's some similarity between these invasions, and that there in this war between Russia and Ukraine, there's no good side and evil side. It's two evil sides confronting each other. Is that right, Judith? Right? Yes. Okay. Ça va, Marlène?
Ça va.
D'accord.
Merci.
De rien.
I think also it's important to remember that Russian reality is that they lost 27 million people in the Second World War, and that they have a genuine reason to be totally traumatized by the idea of being encircled. Mm-hmm.
Which they are now by US NATO military bases. Yes, totally.
But which is something which it doesn't come out very much. I haven't seen it in any of the major newspapers or on the newscast, a mention of the fact that NATO and US military bases have been all along the borders of Russia. With I think it's something like 300 bases, and as some people have rightly pointed out, can you just imagine if Russia had 300 bases along the Canadian and Mexican border, how the United States would react? So here they're building up public opinion on the fact that it's unacceptable that Russia is not negotiating and so forth, but they never mentioned that we're asking for negotiations without agreeing to withdraw the proposal that Ukraine join NATO, and while we maintain these military bases all along the borders with even increased arms in the past years.
I agree with Martin, and also it is not mentioned that there was an agreement between the West and Russia, or at that time Soviet Union, that they were not going to move the Western borders closer to Russia in exchange for the reunification of Germany, and also new Germany's membership. So this agreement wasn't honored. So I am totally against the invasion. I don't support wars, but it's a provocation by the West. And they argue that they were going to follow the political path, but they are also provoking. Plus, there was also a coup d'etat that was fully supported by the West, and they invested $5 billion in that illegal coup d'etat in Ukraine. I think that Ukraine is really a key spot for the West to have in terms of nuclear weapons. So they don't respect anything. I mean, the West.
Yeah, but of course, Ukraine is the geographically between the Western bloc and Russia. So, I mean, it's as somebody has said, this is not so much a war in Ukraine, which it is, of course, but it's about Ukraine, or it's over Ukraine, unfortunately for Ukraine. And now we see all the talking about NATO and its expansion. I've heard reports that in Finland now, a poll, 70% of Finns now want Finland to join NATO, which they've always resisted and not wanted to do. But they have quite a long border with Russia, over 1,000 kilos, I think, and have always stayed neutral. But now there's a, and of course, this is grist, absolute grist for the mills of the weapons producers. There's a huge, huge, huge industry, the most profitable enterprise that is legal that you can get into is making, producing and selling weaponry, weapons of war. And it's called a military industrial complex, but sometimes I think that's too narrow a framing. I've heard people say it should be military, industrial, academic, bureaucratic, and on and on. Before those weapons can be made, they have to be designed and thought of. So you have academics and intellectuals working, using the human power on producing more and more lethal weaponry, and then it gets made and then it gets sold. And you don't have, apparently, I heard, any, the reason it's so profitable is because none of the so-called market forces are at work when you make and sell weapons of war. You don't have the same level of, nearly the same level of competition you do, say, if you're making trucks as opposed to tanks, just to simplify it. If you make trucks, you've got to put ads in Time magazine and all the major, and so on. You don't do that if you're making tanks. You don't have much competition. Many of the contracts are handed out without any tendering of them whatsoever. And of course, it's all done with public funds. Public funds subsidize the production. It's a government subsidizes it. And then it's governments who buy the weapons at the other end. And that's public funds again. It's your and my taxes are buying them. And the cost overruns, which are often up to 300%, just get paid automatically without any question. You hear that with our own procurement, as they call it. So we order up fighter jets and they're going to call, or warships or whatever it is, they're going to cost X billion dollars, and oh, when we finally get them, guess what? The bill is twice as much. And who's paid for all that? We have, no? So of course, as they say, it's the biggest, easiest way to siphon money out of the public purse straight into private pockets. And that's why it flourishes, because a few people make a great deal of money out of it. But you don't have a weapons trade if you don't have war. You have to have perpetual war to keep that business going. And that's a big factor in all of this too. And when NATO expanded, one of the big, who profited? With those very people, because all the Eastern European countries that joined had to make their militaries what they call interoperable, hate the word, with the US and everybody else in NATO, which meant they had to buy the same equipment and the same everything. It made them, forced them to spend money on the military things rather than what their people actually needed.
Do you think that's why now, Judy, nobody's talking about ceasefires?
Nobody's talking about what?
Having a ceasefire.
Well, people are saying that's what should happen, but nobody seems to be working at producing it, as far as I can hear. I don't know. Does anyone know who's gone with the intention of trying to negotiate a ceasefire? They have these little ones that are supposed to create humanitarian corridors, and they haven't.
Yeah, but that still allows them to shoot off those cruise missiles, which are huge and deadly.
Well, from the very start, the impression we got was that NATO allied countries and the United States were actually pushing for a war. You know, for days they were saying, oh, it's imminent, it'll be tomorrow or in the coming days. And then, oh, we think it'll be tomorrow and so forth. If you're trying to use force in negotiations, but you don't really want to use war, then it seems to me you wouldn't prepare public opinion and sort of make people expect it's going to happen tomorrow morning. It's almost as if they were pushing the Russians to take military actions. And this, of course, is serious. I mean, there's the arms trade that Judith was talking about, but then we mustn't forget that in the past few years, there's been like a turn of attitude towards nuclear weapons. And if the United Kingdom, for example, has announced a 45% increase in its nuclear stockpile. Now, that is just, I mean, already there was more than enough to destroy humanity several times. Mm. So increasing the stockpile by 45% is madness. And we mustn't forget that this is not in the context of what it would have been a few years ago. It's in the context of increasing nuclear stockpiles and greater tension worldwide. So there is no option but to pressure all these belligerent countries to stop the war as soon as possible before there are thousands and thousands of casualties.
Ce qu'on constate aussi, c'est que avec cette guerre là, on est loin de s'en aller vers aucune paix, parce que ça incite tout le monde à s'armer davantage. Des pays qui n'étaient pas du tout dans cette logique-là, comme l'Allemagne, comme la Norvège, comme le Japon, ces pays-là commencent à vouloir s'armer un peu plus, et probablement que ça va faire l'affaire des vendeurs d'armes, parce que c'est un commerce très lucratif et qui va permettre aux États qui produisent des armes de s'enrichir. Alors, je ne sais pas comment ça va déboucher cette affaire-là.
Marlene is saying that she doesn't know how this is going. We're going to find a way out of this terrible situation because we're in a situation where more and more countries are increasing their weapons, like Germany, Switzerland, Japan, that did not have a tradition of stocking weapons. This makes it difficult to see how we're going to get out of this situation, because this is a very lucrative market, and some people have the possibility of making a lot of money with this situation.
I think that, yes, that's exactly the problem, that countries rely heavily, their economies rely heavily on the destruction of the environment and the manufacturing of war weapons. US, Canada, and now more and more countries are joining NATO. So there needs to be a change in the system in order for, end this production of weapons and relying on that as an income.
Marlene's point is quite right about countries like Germany, for instance, has just doubled its, or is it doubled, but increased its military budget. Japan's post-war constitution had it not having any armed forces, and now that is, you know, been changing, and so the world is becoming more militarized and less militarized. And as Martine says, bristling with nuclear weapons, and in this case, we have a almost direct confrontation between two nuclear powers. I mean, NATO is trying to avoid that by resisting the no-fly zone, because, of course, if there were to be a no-fly zone, it would have to be enforced and the only enforcement possible would be by NATO, and that would put direct confrontation between the US and Russia, and very likely end up with the use of nuclear weapons, because that's the problem with war. You don't control, it starts escalating and you don't control where it ends up. An escalation of this war could be nuclear.
Is there a place where everything goes? Everyone's looking and nobody knows. Is there a way, a map or a sign? Or is it just dreaming all in the mind? She lives on her own, the children are gone. They talk on the phone, but they don't talk for long. She tells herself stories, sings herself songs, turns back the clock and tries to hold on, and looks for the place where everything goes. Everyone's looking and nobody knows. Is there a way, a map or a sign? Or is it just dreaming all in?
Days are so long, he doesn't work anymore. Doesn't know who he is, doesn't know what he's for. A rudderless ship, a pawn in the game. He's losing himself, but he tries just the same to look for the place where everything goes. Everyone's looking. Is there a way, a map or a sign? Or is it just dreaming all in the mind? All in the mind.
Love, happiness, money, stuff. Whatever we have, it's never enough. So little space and never the time. No room. Treasure we're trying to find. There isn't a place where everything goes. Everyone's looking and everyone knows. There isn't a way, a map or a sign. Everyone's dreaming it's all in.
What's the role of fossil fuels in this build-up that we're seeing and in this conflict? Surely, you know, the fossil fuels are used for the weapons, all weapons, you know, oil and gas and coal.
I know that that the military uses an awful lot of fossil fuels. I saw something like 16 liters per day per soldier, am I right? I'll try and find it and tell you, but so a war is not only terrible for all the reasons we've mentioned, but it's also terrible for the climate crisis in a time where, on the contrary, we would need to have a sort of cooperation between everybody to reduce our use of fossil fuels. Well, in fact, the war will increase the use of fossil fuels just for the military interventions.
And the other thing is that the fossil fuels that are used, even when we're not at war, just in preparing for war, doing war games and maneuver training and testing, all that kind of thing, are not even calculated in the country's emission. For instance, when Canada says how many whatever it is per year that we're responsible for, that does not include what the Canadian military is producing in greenhouse gas emissions. And same thing in the United States. In the statistics about greenhouse gas emissions, the fossil fuels used by the militaries are not included. And I think that's ridiculous. I mean, that's something that surely we could try and get fixed right away so people could see what the contribution is. It's huge, as Martin is saying. But somehow they're given get out of jail card, free card, or a pass on it. We don't count that in our greenhouse gas emission totals. Mm-hmm. Ridiculous.
So what should we do?
Well, that's one thing we could insist on. I mean, it seems to me that's such an obvious one. Perhaps people would agree with us without having to make too huge an argument, just saying when you calculate, everything should be included.
I could share with you the four demands that we made at the end of this demonstration last Saturday, if that's of interest.
Yes, do.
We denounce the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, and we call upon Russia to end its invasion immediately. Then we denounce the responsibility of NATO in the creation of the conditions that led to the war. We want to dissociate from the senseless calls for an escalation of this war by those who ask that NATO establish a no-fly zone over Ukraine. And we call for an immediate end of all bombardments. We call for the immediate end of all bombardments and combats, and for the negotiation of the critical issues at stake that should have been seriously discussed before the war was even called. We'd like to have a simple solution to these problems, but unfortunately we think that the only solution is to pressure for the end of the conflict and negotiations between the parties. And for as many people in the population as possible to come out with such demands to finally succeed in exerting a certain pressure. Just
partial answer to Brisna's question, what should we do? I don't know which we meant, Brisna, but we, the people of the earth, perhaps, as always in a confrontation, it behooves us to find a face saver for the person you want to have back down. And we want Putin to stop, as Martinez just said. But to do that, he needs to save face. Mm-hmm. Surely somebody, I'm not a diplomat or a politician or anything, but there must be something somebody could think of that would allow him to save face without sacrificing anything of importance. I don't know what it might be, but the problem is, other than, of course, obviously, as we call also, although some people for the total dissolution of NATO. I mean, let's just get no to NATO, period. That you're accused of being an apologist for Putin, and it isn't the case at all, of course. I think that's the real challenge. If we really want it to stop, we have to find a way out for Putin, and I don't know what that might be.
Well, I would say just recognizing that Ukraine is a neutral territory, and that NATO will not make offer to incorporate Ukraine. It's a reasonable demand because it was part of the agreement made when Germany was split up that wasn't respected, and it would definitely, as you say, save face in a sense, and justify the withdrawal of your Russian troops.
Yes, I've heard one person say that should be a guarantee in writing that for at least 20 years, somebody suggested Ukraine would not be joined NATO. But I don't know if we can say forever. Nobody can guarantee anything forever, but maybe from Putin's point of view, 20 years would be good enough. He'd probably be gone by then. But in writing this time, because is it true that none of these other former assurances were ever, in fact, in a written document? Is that true?
Well, I don't know, but even sometimes having a written documents is not an enough warranty. And for that, I am going to bring a case in my country. We have peace accord signed, and nothing was really done. So I don't know, it has to be more than written. I don't know what we need really.
I think also we have to talk about the role of the West, you know. I mean, I agree with what you're saying, Julie, in terms of this particular part of the crisis, you know, and that we could, if we could save face for Putin, that would be a good thing. But the problem is much, much bigger than that. I mean, I'm one of the people that can't understand why we even have NATO at this point. I think NATO is a terribly dangerous organization, because the West continues to look for total supremacy. This is the US. I mean, okay, it goes through NATO, but it's basically US imperialism, isn't it? By a slightly different name. And this is what we have to stop. This, the US has gone on too long, bullying everybody. I mean, the whole idea, you know, there was some conductor, I think it was a great Russian conductor, and they made him quit his post as a major conductor because he wouldn't denounce Putin. Now, if we can imagine, you know, the conductors that we have in the West having to give up their jobs because they wouldn't denounce whatever, I mean, it's just, it's US imperialism, which is ultra distasteful, especially as of course is ultra dangerous. It's just trying to humiliate people.
Well, and also of course, it's an empire that's in decline.
Of course, this is why it's bullying.
This war is to stall that decline in part.
Exactly, so we know it is, yeah.
Of course, the bigger picture is much more complicated, but the immediate thing is we want to stop the killing now, stop the, or whatever you call it, the invasion, the war, as soon as possible, and then sit down and talk.
Well, what about this guy, this Zelensky, this guy that's head in Ukraine? Everybody says he's a great hero of his people and everything.
He's a pawn.
I think he's a fool. I mean, he's opened up his country and said, anybody that will come, we will show you how to use a gun. I mean, can you imagine people, amateurs, not knowing a thing about anything, standing there with an AK-47, they don't really basically know one end of it from the other, trying to shoot. I mean, it's absolutely a crazy idea. And all, of course, all the crazies from the West, there are many in Canada, but many in the States as well, and in Europe, they're all flocking to the Ukraine. This is going to be their big moment. I mean, can this help in some way?
Well, apparently that's part of the mythology. Someone was saying Ukraine is not a democracy. It has suppressed the Russian minority linguistically and in other ways. So it's not a multicultural, it doesn't accept.
No, of course not.
The current government is really a puppet regime of the US, having installed it there.
Yes.
After
2014.
Yeah, Crimea. Mm-hmm.
Il y a une possibilité que quelqu'un d'autre que Poutine et le président de l'Ukraine, quelqu'un qui peut entamer le dialogue. Parce que je vois que les deux camps se rencontrent, même pour avoir un corridor humanitaire, c'est pas possible. C'est pas possible d'avoir un corridor humanitaire. Mais est-ce qu'ils vont pouvoir à un moment donné, mettre fin à cette guerre fratricide terrible. Est-ce qu'il n'existe pas dans le système international une possibilité qui est une intervention d'un pays plus ou moins neutre ou bien de gens venant de pays plus ou moins, qui pourraient s'asseoir ensemble pour discuter? Parce que là, Zelensky et Poutine, ça n'ira pas. Poutine a horreur et il méprise Zelensky. Et Zelensky le lui rend bien. Alors, je ne sais pas comment ça va pouvoir se régler cette affaire-là.
Marlène asks if she says she thinks there should be someone somewhere that could step into the negotiation process, because it would be impossible for Putin and Zelensky, that are diametrically opposed, to come to some kind of compromised solution. She's really wondering if we could find this kind of person to step into the negotiation process.
What do we think of the sanctions and the boycotts of Russia?
It hurt the ordinary people of Russia, and eventually they'll hurt all of us too. And they probably won't really hurt the oligarchs. Apparently, where their money is very difficult to trace. And we may get at some of it. We know where their yachts are and where their mansions are, but we don't know where their stashes.
But they're closing everything, Jimmy. They're closing the kushtars in Russia. You know, the grocery stores that are open at night. It's apparently a Canadian company. They're closing them all, everything. The BBC, all the media, it's all being closed.
Well, we sometimes say that there are two parties at war, not only the Russian, but also the West, with the sanctions. Enforcing sanctions on countries is a type of warfare.
It's economic warfare, and
we've seen with the case of Iraq and other countries that sanctions have deadly effects on the population. I mean, sanctions can be related to famines, to a lack of medication, and all sorts of basic necessities. So it's like a way of not seeming to be at war, but actually playing an important part in the war. And don't forget that sanctions have often been denounced by the United Nations because of its deadly impacts on the populations.
So how is this situation going to boomerang on us, on the pain of the Western countries? What's going to happen to us as a result of this Ukraine-Russia problem? Are we going to be affected?
For the time being, I think we will be affected, but in such a minor way as compared to the people that are in Ukraine or in Russia. But definitely, we could be affected if this goes any further and if nuclear weapons are used. A large part of humanity that will be affected, including almost all humanity, because of the effects on the environment, on wildlife, on vegetation, on crops, on contaminated soils, and name it. We're not in a situation where something can be waged in a part of the world and sort of neglected by the rest of the world. We're one and all in together. And we have to see it that way. And we have to convince our governments to see it that way too.
And even if we don't get to the stage of anyone using nuclear weapons, the possibility of hitting a direct hit on the critical structures of any of those nuclear reactors in Ukraine, and they have four sites with nuclear reactors, if the containment of the actual reactor were to be breached, then we'd have release of radiation that would be disastrous even without using the weapons. It's been said that if World War II were fought in Europe today with all the nuclear energy installations, the whole continent would be uninhabitable for centuries, be forever, because of everything would be contaminated with radioactive fallout.
But I was thinking more in terms of the world being so united, so it's one world, really. It's a collective, you know, the supply chains were all linked to China or whatever it happens to be. And I was thinking of the Ukraine as being a breadbasket of the world. Now, what about the basic price of, say, wheat? It's going to go up enormously.
For Europe, especially.
Well, yeah. And bread is a basic product.
No, they supply most of the wheat for Europe, for sure. And also fertilizer, apparently. The potash, I think, is from there.
Yes. So what's going to happen if other countries cannot get the fertilizer, the potash, for instance? We have it here, I think, in Saskatchewan. But, I mean, for most places, what would they do? Countries that are already on their knees, like Lebanon, say nothing of Afghanistan, Yemen, Iraq. I mean, surely there would be mass starvation, no?
By the way, by the way, when we were speaking about humanitarian corridors just before, I've read and I've heard from a person in Ukraine that claimed that what the news we were getting on the fact that the corridors were not respected, that people were being killed in the corridors and so forth. Apparently, it's not that clear. Like, some people have written and some have told that people are leaving through the corridors. So this is, you know, there may be a mercenary here and there who doesn't have much judgment and, you know, sort of didn't know or whatever, but it's not the Russians apparently preventing the corridors from. And the other thing that was said, and, you know, we started off this seminar by saying that unfortunately it's very difficult to know the truth in a time of war because of all the propaganda. But one of the things that I've heard also is that some of the attacks that have been attributed to the Russians in fact were not the Russians but were Ukrainians, but the West is trying to pass it off on Russians in order to build up public opinion against the Russians. But apparently some of the worst acts of destruction, human against the population, have been gestures of Ukrainians. So, you know, once you say this, I can't prove it, obviously, but I, you know, there are sources that seem reliable that have said this. So it's just enough to at least make us question everything we read.
Okay.
C'est sûr que la propagande en temps de guerre, ça marche d'un côté comme de l'autre.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mais je pense que comme la Russie a l'air, là, la Russie est maître de ce qui se passe au niveau de l'aviation. Il y a des gens qui, on les a vus, en fait, on nous les a montrés, j'espère que j'étais pas là quand c'est arrivé. On les a vus qui étaient avec leurs valises, une famille là, qui s'en allait et qui a été, toute la famille a été tuée, mais ça venait du ciel. Alors c'est sûr que dans ces conditions-là, quand il y a un corridor humanitaire, ça suppose qu'il y a un cessez-le-feu le temps que les gens soient évacués. Or c'est cela qui ne se fait pas. Et puis ça, je ne sais pas. Est-ce que ce sont les Ukrainiens? Est-ce que ce sont les Russes? Mais je sais que les Ukrainiens n'ont pas le contrôle de l'air. Mais ça, c'est arrivé. Puis ça, je trouve ça déplorable. Même si, par ailleurs, je trouve que quand on empêche à des étudiants africains qui étaient là, on ne leur donne pas, on les empêche de traverser en Pologne ou ailleurs, là, tout ça épouvantable. Mais je trouve épouvantable aussi que des enfants, là, ces enfants-là vont être marqués à jamais, ceux-là qui en sortiront vivants. C'est que ces choses-là, on les apporte, c'est comme l'esclavage de mes ancêtres, là. C'est une carte qu'on traîne jusqu'à maintenant. Ces enfants-là vont traîner ça jusqu'à je ne sais pas quand. Alors, il faudrait que, quand des femmes essaient de s'échapper avec leurs enfants, qu'au minimum, qu'on les laisse s'échapper, que ce soit les Ukrainiens, que ce soit les Russes, il n'y a pas de discussion là-dessus. Il faut, ces gens-là ne veulent pas rester dans la guerre, ils veulent s'en aller. Il faudrait qu'ils soient capables de fuir.
Marlene explained that war propaganda is not just on one side, it's always on both sides in a war. She pointed out that when a family was leaving and a bomb fell from the sky. Now, we don't know who was in which country was responsible for that. It fell on them, and that's that. But we know that the Ukrainians don't have control of the airspace. It's the Russians in any case. And she mentioned that she finds it terrible when young Africans that were living in Ukraine want to leave the country. They're prohibited from doing so. She finds that terrible. And she also finds terrible the children that are living in Ukraine and that are experiencing all this. And she says that it's going to be with them for years and years and for their lifetime and for several generations, just like the people who were taken in a slave trade have been affected for generations on end following the experience of enslavement. So she doesn't know how to stop all this, but a minimum would be if there is a humanitarian corridor, then there should be a ceasefire to allow people to escape through the humanitarian corridor.
Speaking of propaganda, that the entire Western media apparatus has become a propaganda machine, and the example given of a CBC report that the World Health Organization had said that Russia was attacking hospitals. Mm-hmm. The organization never said that. It merely said that hospitals had been hit or attacked, but didn't say by who, and which speaks to Marlene's point. You don't know who was doing what. You can't say immediately who did it. I suppose it can be determined later where the munitions were made, but even then, maybe it's the twisting of everything.
Well, it's important to be aware of this because the purpose of this propaganda is to manipulate the population. So if we're a bit aware of this and we keep an eye, a critical eye on what we're reading, it can help. And as often as we have a chance to tell others to beware of what's being transmitted on radio, on television, and so forth, that it's not all the truth with a capital T, well, this may help us mobilize on our own basis, on basis of the interest of the population, of the Canadian population, of the world population, against warmongering governments of those countries or the interests of the military industrial complex, as Judith was saying.
So thank you to everybody for participating, and our strong, strong hope is for peace. So thanks to Martine, Brisner, Marlene, Julie, for participating in Older Women Live.
The Collectif Échec à la Guerre has been launching a campaign to pressure the government to sign and ratify the treaty against for the prohibition of nuclear weapons. It's a campaign we're waging over almost 4 months until June. And the purpose is also to get more people aware, you know, through this campaign and through the information and so forth. It's a way of getting people aware that there is an issue there and it would be important to sign this treaty.
Yeah, this is a petition brought about by a member of parliament, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. And it's hosted by Alexandre Boulouris, who's an NPD deputy member of parliament. And it's co-organized by Collectif Échec à la Guerre, Voice of Women for Peace, and the Hiroshima and Nagasaki Day Coalition.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
And the important thing about this new, what is often called ban treaty, banning nuclear weapons, is that it makes the possessing nuclear weapons
legal.
In the same sense that possessing chemical and biological weapons is illegal. I mean, we know it won't get rid of them, but at least it stigmatizes the having of them, delegitimizes their existence even more than is already the case. So it's a very important treaty in the process, eliminating nuclear weapons, which strangely enough, the government says it agrees with that goal, but it won't do anything towards that goal.
No, but it probably can't because of the connection, the link with the US. Huh?
Well, it can. I mean, it
I think it can.
Doesn't have to allow itself to be dictated to by the US.
Well, it is.
But that's a reality. For the
moment. It's a two-hour shame that Canada has not signed. I think 55 countries so far have signed.
Ratified, even. More than that have signed, but 50-something have ratified. It's a two-stage process. You what? Sign first, and then you...
What?
Your own parliament.
Yeah. Well, thanks to everybody. Anyway,
thank you for inviting me, and it was a pleasure to meet you. I've heard about your program through Judith, but it was.
Unfortunately, our time has trickled away. We urge you to do whatever you can for peace and against war, and we hope you found our show informative. An Older Women Live will be on the air the second Wednesday of April. So we hope that you stay safe and that you have a good spring.
The 60s for me was about alternatives and students. Students were saying what was on our mind. Everybody and his sister played a guitar and we were talking to each other. Caffeine was the drug, and I think it was an incredible, incredible time of spontaneity and sharing and communication. They were trying to tell us, however, that there was no war in Vietnam. And a lot of us knew that there was, or we believed that there was. Now, there was a night when I was traveling. Somehow I was stranded in San Francisco Airport. And I had a morning flight on the way to Toronto, where I had an engagement in Yorkville at the Purple Onion, which was, you know, kind of a hippie place, a student movement kind of center. And it was the middle of the night, and some soldiers came in, wheeling their buddies on stretchers and wheelchairs. And I mean, these guys, I had never seen anything like that. These guys were all bandaged and shot up. And I got to talking to some of these soldiers, and they knew that there was a war. But what it did for me, it made me question, well, who is responsible for war? I mean, is it these guys? I mean, you can't just point your finger at them, although they were there. Or maybe it's generals, you know? Maybe it's the generals who make a career of telling these guys what to do. But maybe that doesn't go far enough. I mean, who tells the generals what to do? Who points the generals and the army at somebody else? Ah, it's the politicians. But here I am flying on the way to Toronto, and it had to go farther. By the time I got to the Purple Onion, I said, who elects the politicians? Ah, it's us, right? His orders come from far away no more. They come from him and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put an end to war. It's about individual responsibility.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA, and he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way, and he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds. He says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die. And he never sees the writing on the walls. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at the Hague? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. To a war, and without him all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from him and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put an end to war.
CKUT, CKUT 90.3 FM.
CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
Mandla, your weekly news show with briefings and analysis from the continent of Africa, from a progressive pan-Africanist point of view. And I'm Doug Miller, here with Gwen Shulman.
Here, this time, is we are in Malawi, not in Montreal, and you're about to listen to a rebroadcast because Doug and I are away for Malawi, 1 month, actually. And in the time that we're there, we hope to do some great radio so that when we're back home in Montreal, there's going to be some good, fresh interviews for all of you to listen to. But in the meantime, we've picked some of our favorite shows from the last year to rebroadcast while we're away.
So stay tuned.
When you thought, say, of a thing like apartheid, and you saw so many who seemed to be supporting the racist policies of the former government in South Africa,